Live from 231 Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford, this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. July 1st of this year is the 10-year anniversary of Governor John Rowland's resignation after an impeachment investigation had begun. In the decades since, here's a bit of what he's been up to. He pled guilty to corruption charges, served time in federal prison, was placed under house arrest, got a job right out of jail as an economic development advisor in Waterbury, then got a job as the afternoon talk show host on another Connecticut radio station. It's that last job that may have him repeating the cycle all over again. Today, Where We Live, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, and we are broadcasting from our pop-up radio location, Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford. If you're in the area, we would love for you to come by and join the conversation in person. We're located just to the left of the XL Center marquee in the Hartford 21 building. It's also the space where the very creative guys at the Hartford Denim Company have set up shop. We're going to have a room full of all-star guests today, but my first guest is Bill Curry, former Democratic nominee for governor, advisor to President Bill Clinton. Bill, good to see you today.
Great to be here, John.
Thank you. And you came downtown. I'll just let everyone know that because of the snow in downtown Hartford, because perhaps of the parking situation and some traffic on the roadway, our other guest, Colin McEnroe, who probably should have been here by now, will be joining us.
He's a lazy slug. You know, his life would be so much richer if he just did something. Anything, really. Just try to fill it up.
So Colin will be here. Also, we hope to be joined by Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, who's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, who's fighting the traffic. But again, because we're in downtown Hartford, we invite you to stop by and talk politics with us. Look, we'll start with Governor John Rowland, and Colin's been writing about this. Kevin Rennie at the Hartford Courant has been writing about this. He's back in the news once again, and maybe we'll get into the details of the latest Rowland follies in just a little bit. But back at the time that you were running against John Rowland for governor, as Colin put in a recent blog post, a lot of the media wasn't really paying attention to some of the things that you were saying about the former governor, things that you knew pretty well and things that then later proved out to be true. Talk a little bit about your history with Governor Rowland, sort of what you knew and when you knew it.
Well, I'll go back to actually something even earlier, which Colin also mentioned in that superb distillation of the Rowland history. And here comes the man himself. Going back to the time he left Congress and went to work as a lobbyist for UTC and told people that he was a management consultant. Now, he'd never managed anything in his life. And the idea that he or anyone in his position was going to be hired in such a capacity for an organization as sophisticated, complex, and expansive as United Technologies, it was on its face ridiculous. And it was part of a whole wave that began around that time and continues to this day of people getting around the revolving door bills, of flouting the laws that require that you register as a lobbyist, that report your income, that prohibited congressmen from becoming lobbyists for a year at all. And it's the tradition in which Newt Gingrich says that Fannie Mae hired him to be an historian. You know, Fannie Mae has an historian? It was, you know, it's all ludicrous, but in order to avoid these laws. And that goes back to 1992. And John's life has been a continuous pattern of that conduct. And what's amazing to me is what a poor job all the rest of us have done of constraining him. As in this case, the pattern couldn't be clear. It's been repeating itself for 2.5 decades, or almost, and yet it's able to recur. I mean, this time it's, you know, I don't mean to blame everyone else. It's his responsibility that you could go to prison and come out and get into the kind of trouble that I think he's in now with the same set of laws. One, it suggests that it was an extraordinary waste of one good federal prison bed. That he really got virtually nothing out of the stay. And secondly, it says that we have to work on our own learning curve as to how to deal with corruption. And more than Rowland himself, who for all my two races against him, I don't really know. I met him only in you know, broadcast studios and debate halls. And I never had much feeling about him one way or another. But this pattern of corruption, what people don't understand, and Colin can speak to this better than I can in a second, but this pattern of corruption, among the things we don't understand about it, is how much is actually being taken, and above all, how much it's costing us. After health care, the greatest single cost center driving the inflation in government, outside of entitlements, Social Security, Medicare. After health care itself, the second greatest cost factor driving inflation is corruption. And all the rest of the world knows it. And we in the United States, and unfortunately, we especially in Connecticut, are in denial.
Bill Curry is our guest in the wheelhouse here on Where We Live. Colin McEnroe, our regular guest in the wheelhouse, joins us now. Colin, good to see you.
I was feeling really bad about being stuck in traffic. Then I realized, you got Curry.
Yeah.
This is like his dream.
This is to be.
None of the other guests show up.
Have we met?
Well, Colin, we started a bit by getting some history. We wanted to talk for this first segment about former Governor John Rowland being back in the news. He's back in the news for some unusual reasons, something you laid out in the column, and your colleague, the columnist Kevin Rennie at the Hartford Courant, who unfortunately wasn't able to join us on today's program, has also written extensively about this. What trouble is John Rowland facing right now? You did a pretty good job of explaining it, but I think it needs some explaining.
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult to explain. I'm actually teaching as an adjunct faculty course at UConn Law on John Rowland because there's just
that
much,
true.
Really. I would like to second what Bill said about how he clearly didn't learn anything from prison. I mean, sending John Rowland to prison for 10 months is sort of like sending Lindsay Lohab to rehab for Thursday.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he just really needed more time. You know, this thing, it's a little bit hard to understand, but not that hard to understand. So in the last congressional election cycle, there was a Republican primary for the 5th District of Congress, which is a district which in slightly altered form, Mr. Rowland himself served in Congress many, many years ago. I think Bill was talking about the aftermath of that as I came in. So there was a Republican primary. There were a group of candidates. The candidate that Mr. Rowland liked the most was Lisa Wilson Foley. He spoke up for her on the air. And then at a certain point, all of these things are things that a federal grand jury is trying to pin down. The timeline is going to become very important. But at a certain point, he told his employers, WTIC, that he would be working for the Foley campaign in a volunteer capacity, and he wouldn't be talking about her anymore on the air. Meanwhile, what has surfaced is that he received $30,000 from Lisa Wilson Foley's husband in a different capacity in his long appreciated role as a consultant to nursing home companies, something he has never done before. And so the question became, well, was this another way of paying him? In other words, were they paying him to work on the campaign? He was doing work on the campaign. Were they paying him to work on the campaign, but in a different way? Adding to this problem was the fact that Mark Greenberg, one of the other candidates in the 5th District, came forward and said in the previous cycle, Mr. Rowland had approached him about exactly that kind of scheme.
And I'll just say, Mark Greenberg running for that seat once again, and so he's going to be back in the news answering these sorts of questions potentially for another few months. So Mark Greenberg's another piece of bad news here is there was another guy in the race.
Right. So Mark Greenberg, he had been approached by Rowland about, once again, being paid in a different way, and he had turned Mr. Rowland down. Another candidate in the race was Andrew Rohrbach. Andrew Rohrbach appeared on a John Rowland's show and was sort of surprised to find himself being torn apart on the air. And not only that, but in the course of booking Andrew Rohrbach, Mr. Rowland collected his cell phone number and then later gave it out on the air for people who wanted to call him and harass him about his views about the death penalty. So Andrew Rohrbach subsequently realized when all these facts came out that he was being attacked by John Rowland in almost precisely the same language as the Lisa Wilson Foley campaign was using against him at a time when John Rowland was being paid supposedly for something else by the Foley family. And that's sort of where we are right now. So you've got maybe two potential problems. One of them would be conspiracy to avoid campaign disclosure laws, and maybe a problem with what we call plugola. Plugola means you can't go on the radio and speak on behalf of something when you're getting paid for it if you haven't told anybody that it's essentially paid programming.
And I think one of the things that you try to address in a column that you wrote and in a blog post that you wrote is this question of why does any of this matter? We've been in this state where we see scandal after scandal, whether it's at the state level or it's at the city level. We've seen it right here in Hartford. We've, of course, seen it in Bridgeport and Waterbury involving other people. At the end of the day, Bill, people hear this as a drumbeat of just more of the same, people going back to the trough to take once again. So why does it matter? Why does it really matter to us so much?
One of the things, John, that Colin talked about in his column was the myth among especially Republican sympathizers of the governor ex-governor Rowland, that so little was taken, and then it costs a little. And again, there ought to be, as I've said on this show before, there ought to be a forensic audit every time that there's a finding of a felonious corruption, because we're left with the gross misimpression that far less was taken than really was, and that it cost far less. We never audited, Rowland himself stipulated and swore to about $150,000, $140,000of money taken. It didn't include things. Remember, there was a company called TRIA that was set up, and it was an acronym for Tommaso, Elif, and Alibozic, the three who were also found guilty. And they said at the time that the R stood for responsibility, as opposed to, say, Rowland. And none of that was ever audited. None of the rest of the whole bond agenda. I mean, it all should have been taken apart so that people understood just how expansive this was. I found in my campaign with two great staff people, the two buildings that alone, so if you count that one of them, the Long Lane School, really wasn't useful for its stated purpose, the cost was $100 million. No one looks back and remembers, in a lot of these articles, the CRA case. Rowland was the head of the Republican Governors Association, and they and arranged for a bunch of corrupt people here to forge a so-called loan to Enron. Towns lost $220 million. And so Enron is on the phone raising money for Rowland. They're setting up this cash transfer to Enron of $220 million. I remember Rowland being asked, Ken Lay of Enron, later disgraced, was on a telephone call. And I remember Rowland saying he didn't remember if Lay was on the phone call. It was like going to a Rolling Stones concert, not remembering whether Mick Jagger was there. And they would just put these absolutely impossibly incredible explanations out. The state employee union, again, the unions were punished for supporting me, a violation of their First Amendment rights, as Republican and Democratic justice judges alike found. It's a huge amount of money. The hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in hard corruption, before you even get to the soft corruption of influence peddling. The one, I believe, terrible deal that is probably not legally, it would be hard to prove it was an actual felony.
Yes.
But the one deal on health care to keep us paying more, the state paying more for its regular health insurance premiums to the providers. When Malloy took office, he found that one deal by Rowland's budget director, Mark Ryan, who later went to work for one of the companies that got a fortune out of it, was responsible for half the deficit, the record historic largest deficit since we were a colony, that Malloy met. Half of it came out of one deal to get one guy a job. If the public stopped and just stood back and saw the billions of dollars lost in this period, literally billions of dollars, they'd be even angrier than they are, and they'd be demanding change.
Colin?
Yeah, maybe just a way to look at this is, at the time of the impeachment hearings and afterwards, I talked to legislators, and they said, well, we did it. We got him. He's gone. Problem solved. And obviously, the problems ran deeper than that. And you see it over and over again, that no political structure really wants to cope with corruption. And they don't want to deal with it on either side of the aisle, either. So what happens after that? You've got a problem with Senator DeLuca, who's basically involving mob-connected trash haulers in the life of the state legislature, and they really had a lot of trouble dealing with that. You have the problem with Braddock, who's the finance director for Chris Donovan, the speaker. They had a lot of trouble coping with that and understanding what that was. So, yeah, they solved that one problem, but they're still kind of in denial. I mean, the political structure, the bipartisan political structure, is more attached to its own incumbency than it is to running a cleaner operation up there.
I want to welcome in Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, who joins us regularly on The Wheelhouse. She's associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. She was good enough to brave the weather and the traffic and everything to come up from the South today. Kalila, good to see you once again. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Before we move on, I want to get you to weigh in on this, and I think one of the things that is really important that both Bill and Colin are saying is that we don't pay close enough attention. We don't take a close enough look at why this is an issue and how much it may cost us down the road. But so whether or not it's at the state level or maybe at the federal level, how do we get around this? How do we begin to solve the problem if we see all of this corruption around us and no one seems to want to do anything about it?
I think part of the problem is the public has a very short memory. So when these things happen, there's an immediate response, there's immediate outrage, we want someone to pay for this. And then we go on to the next issue. And what happens is we've become desensitized to it. I think a lot of people see corruption as endemic to the political process itself. But I think what we're talking about today is how this matters to how people live on an everyday basis. We can talk about a bridge closure in New Jersey and make some guesses about what might have happened if there had been a delayed ambulance response. But we know that it's affected the daily lives of people in this state. Corruption, not just at the local level, but at the state level as well. And now as we're hearing, ties to national issues. So I think we have to let the public know, dollar for dollar, this is how this translates into the quality of your life, how your tax dollars are being spent, and demand action.
But, and I think part of it, too, I'm glad you brought up the Chris Christie thing, because immediately when we hear about that, the first thing that anybody on the 24-hour cable channels wants to talk about is, what does this mean for Chris Christie's run for president?
Right.
That's the least important thing out of all of it. How much money did it cost people? Was there anybody who was just late for their kids' very important violin practice? These are the things that actually happened that day in New Jersey that we don't seem to care about because we want to talk about politics all the time.
Right. And let's talk about how politics matters. What's the translation, as you say, into these day-to-day quality of life issues? And I think it's not just disrespectful, but it's a disservice to what we expect the political process to be about, what we expect the elected officials to do. They should be accountable to us. I don't really care about Chris Christie's presidential run if I know that someone couldn't get to the doctor in time, or as you said, missed an important life event. That's how we have to start approaching these issues, and then maybe we can root out some of that corruption.
But it seems like when we start to talk about it, we think about how are we going to get money out of politics, as though that's the problem. It seems as though, Colin, all of our attempts to get money out of politics, whether at the state level or at the federal level, have just resulted in more money in politics and more of the sorts of things that we're talking about today.
Well, yeah, that's the unhopeful lesson to learn from Citizens United and stuff like that. But, you know, I think the larger thing that Kalilah is talking about is really important, which is that cults of personality are expensive. Corrupt governments are expensive. Dictators are expensive. They don't make the trains run on time. You look over to Russia, you know, half the country doesn't have potable water. They spend $50 billion on the Olympics. You know, so Putin has a cult of personality there. And it doesn't provide good government. I mean, we didn't get good government during the Roland cult of personality, which, by the way, during that 10 years or so, it really was a cult of personality here. He was able to get away with a lot of stuff because people invested him with a whole bunch of qualities that I think were probably kind of unrealistic.
And I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in the media bought into it, and certainly the Democrats who conspired with Governor Roland on a number of different issues over the years worked with him as well. Bill, quickly, if you would.
I think they prefer the verb collaborate.
Yeah. what did I use?
Conspire.
Conspire?
Yeah.
I'm not saying you're wrong.
It just came to mind.
In my second race with Roland, we did two things. One that I'm proud of. One was that we laid out the entire case for corruption, on which all those people eventually went to jail. It was over those two property deals that were rigged. And the second one was that we discovered and documented well the extraordinary shortfall in the state budget, which Roland and all the officials connected to him later shown to have known was completely true and all lied through their teeth. And there was a state statute that needed to be enforced that required a reporting and accounting of it. And all the Democratic leaders in that time, statewide and legislative, were supposed to appear with me at a press conference calling for it. And then none of them did. And I needed the validation of someone besides me as a candidate saying it. The same thing happened in California. Gray Davis was lying about his budget deficit. They had a recall position, and he was taken out months later for it. When the public discovered the lie that Roland had told about the budget, the massive layoffs that followed, that are the source of the litigation that we were talking about earlier, his popularity dropped enormously. Most of the popularity he lost was over that lie. By the time people found out about the corruption, he couldn't fall any further. He lost only 3 or 4 points in popularity during all of that because people were already furious over the lie told over the budget.
We're talking today with Bill Curry. He's a former Democratic nominee for governor, former advisor to Bill Clinton. Kalila Brown Dean is an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. And as always, Colin McEnroe joins me. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. It's Wednesday. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin mentioned the cult of personality. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Winter Olympics in Russia and how that relates to what's going on in Ukraine right now. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back live from 231 Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford. It's The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. Live from 231 Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford, this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our pop-up radio location. Periodically, we broadcast from downtown Hartford in this really nice space under the marquee of the Excel Center on Trumbull Street. So you can stop by and say hi. We've got coffee and donuts. I think there's still some coffee and donuts left. You can also peruse some of the wares from the Hartford Denim Company. This is a space that they're occupying temporarily, and they're selling some of their handcrafted Made in Hartford products right here. Today, of course, it's Wednesday, The Wheelhouse, so we're taking a look at the week's news with Colin McEnroe, Bill Curry, and Kalila Brown Dean from Quinnipiac University. We're going to move back to state issues, but I want to talk about the Ukraine for a moment. We've been checking in on the political turmoil there for the last several months. Connecticut's junior senator Chris Murphy traveled to Kiev with John McCain to support protesters there, but in the last 36 hours or so, things have taken another turn for the worse. We've seen live video coming out of that country showing Molotov cocktails being hurled at police, police retaliating. As of right now, or at least when this was written, the AP says that the Ukrainian health ministry is reporting 25 people have died, more than 240 injured in the clashes. Kalila, this is hitting me especially hard right now, not just because this is where my people are from, the Ukraine, but also because it seems as though the rest of the world is kind of laughing along with Vladimir Putin. He's put together an Olympics, which, as Colin talked about, has cost an awful lot of money, but seems to be in some ways going off better than some had expected. Putin is often shown shirtless riding a horse. We chuckle about this, but he helped to start a fire that is now burning down Kiev, it seems. Do you think that America is just not paying close enough attention to what's happening here?
Well, I think that it's part of the problem. We have long outlived this pace where we can say domestic politics is distinct from foreign affairs. What's happening in Ukraine has a lot to do with how we view ourselves as a world leader and what we expect people to do. So the Olympics becomes this monumental distraction that people would rather hear Bob Costas talk about who hit the triple Lutz than think about people dying in the streets of the Ukraine, doing what we take for granted here in the U.S. So the cult of personality is tremendous here when we talk about Putin. And the way that we can shift the narrative away from the ways that people are really suffering in the streets. We need a respite. We need a break from that ongoing conflict. But we shouldn't take that break at the expense of turning our back on what's happening in other parts of the world.
And I think, Bill, part of the reason, though, that we look away from it is we see Vladimir Putin as someone who, if you watch the NBC telecasts, is a world leader who is present at these Olympic Games, not someone who is despotically controlling this enormous country, running it into the ground in many ways, and as a kind of a puppeteer, playing with the people of Ukraine, playing with the European Union. It's something that we're just not paying close enough attention to, it seems, while the skaters go by.
I thought a week before the Olympics that Putin might live to regret having hosted it, and that's clearly wrong. I missed that call. This has been a PR bonanza for him, despite everything, and it just says a couple things. First of all, the limitations. It underscores a couple of really important things people understand. One of which is the limitations of our power. This has been a half century's history in this part of the world, of all of Eastern Europe and into the former Soviet Union. We couldn't go into Hungary in 1956 when there was a revolution. We couldn't go into help Alexander Dubček in 1968 because there are limitations to what you can do. We only intervene in those parts of the world where we think we can get away with it, understandably. The politics of it is very confusing. The Ukraine and our belief, the idea that we were at the end of history and that everyone was going to embrace market democracy, there are such strong anti-democratic strains here. The thing to think about, Viktor Yanukovych is the president of Ukraine right now, a total Putin stooge. People didn't realize it when they elected him. His two predecessors, Yulia Tymoshenko, was put in prison And Viktor Yushchenko, that he said, Viktor Yushchenko was poison. They had an orange revolution, then they turned him orange with a dioxin. This isn't anything like a democracy. So what do? Our hands are tied. We don't know enough. We don't have enough Ukrainian-speaking people, the politics. When people ask me who's going to win a primary in New Britain, which is the next town over, I tell them it's too complicated to know. And primaries are my hobby. Our ability to go in, whether it's the Syrian opposition, the Ukrainian politics, we need, in every one of these issues, whether it's corruption here or in Metro North that we're going to talk about, there are systemic problems. And the systemic problem here is that we need to fix the United Nations. We need to do two things. We need to fix the Security Council, and then we need to clarify the criteria for intervention and pressure. We cannot go on as the policemen of the world. It's too much. We've got a situation like this which is intolerable, and we don't have mechanisms of multilateral conflict resolution or human rights enforcement to go in there. It's time somebody got up and gave that speech in the Democratic Party, certainly, or either party, to talk about creating this a new world order that can go in there and do something about it.
Because there's a lot to talk about today in the wheelhouse, we're going to turn back to Connecticut, and we're going to turn to Metro North. Governor Malloy, on our show not too terribly long ago, had some strong words for Metro North. He met privately with officials and then held a press conference at the Capitol where Malloy said the commuter rail line has lost the confidence of many of our riders and citizens in the state of Connecticut, and it's their job to earn it back. So to that end, Colin, what do you think it takes for Metro North to earn back this confidence, and what do you think the state's role is in all this?
Well, the state's role is gigantic, and there's something a little bit disingenuous about the state's current position about this, whether we're talking about Malloy or the legislators. I mean, they are, as I wrote this weekend, kind of drunk uncle. You know, they come in, they smash the ceramic pig where the transportation money is, and then they stagger off into the night to spend it on whores and firecrackers. And then they get mad because the rail lines haven't been maintained right, things aren't working well, and they say, who did this? Yeah. How did this happen? Well, three guesses how this happened. Part of it was you guys didn't fulfill your end of the bargain. So it's at least a 50-50 problem. It might be worse than that. So for Governor Malloy or anybody else in leadership here in the state to pretend that this is something that just happened on Metro North then is ridiculous. Now, having said that, Metro North has huge problems. Last night, there was this kind of hearing, or it was sort of like a gripe session.
It's a gripe session, near as we could tell, yeah.
In Fairfield for Metro North and the state DOT to hear complaints. One of the things that I kind of had discovered recently is that using digital media, the commuters are talking even more and more and organizing themselves even better. And, you know, and there are all these sites now where you can post, like, the latest outrage, the thing that happened. So they're very much in communion with one another, and they're really upset. Yeah, I mean, it's substandard train service.
So, Kalei, I mean, what do we do about this, given we've talked about this in the program before? We have a multi-state system. Mm-hmm. If Connecticut on its own could act and say, put this out for bid, something we tried to get Governor Malloy to talk a little bit about, which he sort of waited, he dipped his toe into that field. But at the end of the day, Connecticut has to deal with New York State. They have to deal with this massive infrastructure. Can we really do anything to change the way Metro North is run?
Well, I think that's part of the challenge, right? You're dealing with multi-state jurisdictions. You're dealing with different levels of ridership, different levels of economic responsibility and contribution as well. Malloy's first priority has to be to the people of Connecticut. How do you connect your residents with jobs, with education that they need to be able to go? So I think this public show of holding Metro North feet to the fire is just that. It's a public show. Riders want to know, how are you going to compensate me for all the trips that I lost because of the rail shutdown? How do you deal with the increased demand from Connecticut residents? And no one, I'm not hearing that from Senator Blumenthal, I'm not hearing that from the governor, I'm not hearing that from Metro North. How are you going to address that basic question? And until we get to the point, we can't even really think about what's happening in New York and New Jersey and other states because we haven't figured it out here at home.
I agree with everything that's been said. We go through this sort of kabuki theater of deflected responsibility. The state of Connecticut owns the rail lines, it owns the equipment, it owns the cars, it owns the stations, it owns the parking garages adjacent to them. One of the problems is that that Metro North is sort of the Fannie Mae of club car trains. No one can find out where the responsibility is in these hybrid organizations that are in fact constructed to deflect
and confused as to where responsibility lies. And you have four houses of two legislatures, two governors, federal responsibility. You have the Metropolitan Transit Authority and then Metro North underneath it. All these things, the first thing that people who are in government should be figuring out is why they haven't been overseeing this better. So you bring in some other private contractor to be the Metro North nestled in that extraordinarily Byzantine nest. Who's to say you're going to oversee them any better than you did the last guys? The second thing, if I can just take half a minute, and that is that you step back even one more step, and you realize that there's a problem. There's not enough money to pay for safety. There's not enough money to pay for good service because we haven't done the other things in this society to make mass transportation work. And it starts with what Colin said about raiding these other funds for the wrong purposes. But we need property tax reform in this state. We need land use planning. We need to stop using economic development authority to have fund and to subsidize sprawl. If you don't deal with the systemic problems in society, with your dying cities, with your mass transit lines, you won't be able to make the train system work. So there are 100 other reasons to do it, but that sure is one of them.
It just seems as though the busiest commuter line in America, going to the biggest, richest city in America, taking people from one of the richest counties in America, should be able to, Kalila, in some way find the money to do something to make this change.
I think that the commuters in Fairfield County would say the very thing. They would be willing to commit to that so that they could have a more efficient transportation system. But we talked in the last segment about money and politics. This is a clear example where more money in politics does not guarantee better service, does not necessarily mean that we're making things more fair or people more involved. So if we have the money, and as you said, can we pay for safety? Are we saying that, yes, we want you to be safe, but we also want you to be able to get to New York City in a record amount of time? To some extent, we have to be realistic as voters about what we can actually, you know, afford and what we want, what's priority. But again, how are we going to hold people accountable? Is it necessarily opaque?
We're talking with Dr. Kalila Brown, Dean from Quinnipiac University. Bill Curry is our guest. This is Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Before we take our break, I just want to get to one more thing concerning the current governor. We've been talking, Colin, for the last several weeks about whether or not Governor Daniel Malloy is going to run for re-election. He finally comes out this week and says, no, I'll say something about this, but it's going to wait until May now, around the time of the state convention, around the time that the state legislative session is over. As the Hartford Current put it, you know, who's he kidding, really? Everyone knows that he's going to run again. Do you think there's anything else to this? I've not really seen a sitting governor string us out like this to say whether or not he's running.
Yeah, I think why is now a fair question. And obviously, there's a lot of disclosure that you have to do when you start running, which you don't have to do when you're not running. And I have no choice. Absent another explanation, I have no choice but to assume that he's just not interested right now in engaging in whatever disclosure would be necessary. We know that there has been unprecedented, historic levels of Democratic fundraising here in the state of Connecticut. At least I think it's probably unprecedented. And so I assume he just doesn't want to talk about it. I think it's appalling, though. I mean, I really do think it's something he ought to be held accountable for and that people ought to feel free to object to.
But is it really appalling, Kalila? I mean, he wants to wait for a while. What he told me is, look, he wants to talk about the upcoming legislative session. Mm-hmm. He wants to talk about government. He doesn't want to talk about politics. Is it really that big a deal if he makes us wait?
I think whether he declares now or waits until May, he's already a candidate in terms of how people perceive him, how people will interact, and what's going to come up in this next legislative session and what we expect him to do in that regard. I don't see it as appalling just because I think it's sort of par for the course when we think about what sitting candidates or sitting politicians are doing across the country. But for the Democratic Party, the question is, what's next? If for some fluke he decides he's not going to run, how are they going to field a viable candidate in a week?
Well, he told me Nancy Wyman would make a great governor, the current lieutenant governor. He said that to me on Where We Live.
Well, and I think that's a wonderful sentiment. But does it give? Has she been briefed on this to have the time to prepare for that in a week? And what it means for not just Democrats, what's the strategy of the Republican Party, the Republican candidate going to be? If you don't have your confirmed opponent, How do you work on your strategy?
The incumbents, presidents, governors, this is the big, about 20 years ago this started. 1996, I worked for Bill Clinton, and I told him it was a good idea to do what he did, which was announce his reelection on a train on his way to the convention. Okay? So we waited till the day before when nobody could even cover it because you didn't want to politicize the debate. You wanted everything you did to look official. There is another issue here of financial accountability, et cetera, and I don't mean to slight that at all. But the fact of the matter is that every incumbent thinks it's in their interest to delay the politicization of the public's perception of them, and B, not to elevate their opponents, all of them or one of them or wherever the opposition is in its process, because the moment it's a race, everybody's more important. And so you're just trying to put that off. It's a perception game. The media could treat it differently, regardless of what formal status a candidate claims. There's an easy way to flush this out more. But I completely understand why Malloy or anyone else in his position thinks it's a really good idea for him.
I just said appalling because there are people who are apparently not part of Governor Malloy's campaign staff, I'm making air quotes here, who get mad when I say things like that. So I enjoy irritating them. Yeah. Because they're part of his campaign staff,
It's a brilliant strategy, and I'm guessing it worked again.
We're talking with the ever-popular Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Bill Curry is with us as well, and Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Coming up after this break, we'll be talking about some more things that are in the news this week. We'll touch on drones in the news, maybe UConn football back in the news, and also the closing of a Hartford and West Hartford landmark. We'll see about that. It's coming up next in The Wheelhouse, Where We Live. Live from 231 Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford, this is Where We Live. It's The Wheelhouse today, our weekly news roundtable. I'm John Dankosky, joined as always by Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, you're going to be here later on today in this very same spot. What do you got on the show?
Yes, and first of all, we invite people to come. There's a lovely, comfortable audience area here. We're going to be talking about, it's still the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. It's still going on. So
it's been going on for a while.
So we want to talk about sort of Connecticut's record in the Civil War, and we're going to be bringing back Matt Warschauer and some other historians to talk about. I mean, we tend to congratulate ourselves about what a great place Connecticut is and how high-minded we were.
Which is true.
Maybe it is now, but not so true 1850s, 1860s. The story's a little bit different. So we're going to burst some bubbles.
Okay, so we're going to burst some bubbles about the Civil War in Connecticut coming up 1 o'clock this afternoon. And again, we're at 231 Trumbull Street. If you're looking for it on Trumbull Street, it's right under the marquee of the XL Center. It's at Hartford 21. The city of Hartford has made the space available to us in case you look in the window and you don't see a radio show, but you see a lot of denim items. This is where the Hartford Denim Company is selling some of their wares. Also joined today by Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac, and our regular contributor, Bill Curry, a former Democratic nominee for governor and former advisor to President Bill Clinton. So let's start this segment, Colin, because we've got to run through a lot, with some news that I think is hitting an awful lot of people hard. Crown Market in West Hartford, it seems, is closing. Explain to people what Crown Market is if you don't live in the Hartford area.
Yeah, Crown Market is one of those sort of, first of all, it was a long-time family-owned market. It's changed ownership, changed hands a few times, but still a locally-owned supermarket, small supermarket. But its main thing is that it specializes in kosher, does kosher cooking there. So it's a culture. I mean, it's a food market, but it's also a culture.
So it's something that I know you've been talking about over the course of the last day or so, and a lot of people are responding to you. This is a place that people don't want to see close. I got a note from Tovia Smith, the NPR reporter who a lot of people listen to, said, that was my family's market. This can't happen. People are really responding to this.
Yeah, actually, I posted an idea, which is sort of taking the consumer, the community-supported agriculture idea, which I know you, Mr. Dankosky, subscribe to.
I do love this.
And I came up with CSK, community-supported kosher. The idea would be you'd buy a share the way you do in a farm, and maybe what you do is like have $100 debited from one of your cards every month, not unlike our monthly membership here at WNPR, and then you'd have $100 to spend at the Crown, and they'd have the money up front. The response I've gotten to this is incredible. So my What I would say for now is it's not over until the lady who maybe she should cut back a little bit on the stuffed cabbage sings.
It's a fantastic idea. Actually, really, I love this idea. So, again, you can read more about this in the Hartford Current, but we'll be talking about this in the future, Colin. I like this idea. I like
CSK.
This idea. The CSK is a great idea. A few more things that we want to touch on quickly. A freelance videographer with WFSB is suing the Hartford Police Department after he got in trouble for flying a drone over a car accident. Kalila, I think it's going to be a really interesting time for us in the news media. We're trying to figure out what role drones are going to play in our lives, how they're going to be regulated, whether or not, say, Amazon is going to start a delivery from some headquarters down here in Windsor and dropping little tchotchkes off in my front yard. What are we learning right now about the world of drones and how we're going to regulate them, whether it's the media or commercial or anything else?
Well, I think this was a good story to break when it did, because most Americans don't even know what a drone really is. They think it's some top secret piece of equipment that only the U.S. military owns. And with all the snow we've had lately, the idea of someone delivering something by drone to your door may actually be appealing.
It does sound kind of nice, doesn't it?
It sounds kind of nice, you know, fighting the snow. But what we know now is we don't know a lot. There's not a lot of regulation the way that it would be for, say, a news chopper that would be in the airspace to cover a story. The fact that you now have people who bill themselves as drone attorneys, what does that really mean? You know, and do we want that kind of policy?
And again, this is an attorney
a
drone,
not
an attorney who is a drone.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on who you ask. You never know, right? But it is the fact that we're sort of behind the ball on this one, that drones have become popular before we had a lot of regulation, which means that we're making these laws up on the spot. And the question is that something that a police officer should be making the call about? Should it be a news station that may or may not occasionally hire someone? Or is it up to individual citizens to use their best discretion?
Well, look, we've spent 30 years on the internet making rules up as they go, Bill. I mean, is this sort of the same thing?
In a way, it is. I'm deeply apprehensive about drones and individual right to privacy. It's unclear to me from this story what interest the police felt they had. Was it a safety interest and a drone being overhead? Is the police department the entity that protects the personal privacy of people? I'm not sure anyone's delegated that to them. I'm not sure I want anyone to do that. There are privacy issues here. We live in an age of ceaseless surveillance. It isn't just our privacy, but our very personhood, which is under attack. There was a great public television piece on social media and how it shapes people in ways they don't know. We're under assault, and so I get the concern here, but I also get that if there's anyone I want to have the maximum ability to record what's going on, it actually still is, with all its warts and blemishes, the press, and this standoff between the police and everyone with a camera is something which really goes to the heart of accountability.
Well, and this is something that we saw
in New Haven all over again.
We've seen this in New Haven. We've seen this, the worries that the police have about people taking pictures of what's going on versus...
I don't get it. I'm concerned about drones. I'm concerned about privacy. It's also the Newtown fight all over again. It's who are these public officials? Whose privacy are they really protecting? Our history is replete with examples. Usually it's their own.
Colin?
You know, we did a show about this a year and a half or so ago, and I actually called Paul Vance and some other state officials and asking what their policies were about commercial drones. And everybody went, huh, what are you talking
what do you
about?
Mean, commercial drones?
I do think, by the way, they need a different name. It's like root canal. If they called it something else besides drones, they probably wouldn't have quite so many problems. Drones scare people. But this is, there are two universities that now have departments of drone journalism. They are really looking at this. This is going to happen. We should be making Patrick Scahill the head of WNPR drone journalism. It's going to happen. The question is, you know, when are the laws and regulations going to catch up with it? What are they going to be? And I think the other two panelists have highlighted some of the issues that are going to come up.
Yeah, calling a root canal like a mouth party or something. Okay. I don't think this should all be about language. Okay,
it helps.
I think it runs deeper, but I take your point.
If you have questions about community supported kosher, if you have questions about how to name a drone, maybe you can just get it right to Colin McEnroe.
Buzzy, call it Buzzy. Buzzy the drone.
Buzzy at Colin at WNPR.org. How much time do we have left, Katie? About 3.5 minutes, so we got time for one more story here. Ernest T. Jones, the UConn football coach who ignited a controversy last month with his comments on religion in the huddle, has resigned. And Colin, this is something that I guess I wasn't terribly surprised about this. I was a little bit surprised about the timing. Essentially, he was talking about keeping Jesus in our huddle. Then the university responded. It seems as though the university is responding a little bit differently to some things in the last few months than they have maybe in the previous several months.
Yeah, I mean, and look, we don't really know this whole story. It's not clear what happened, to be fair. And it could be that Ernest Jones really did look at everything and decide that he was out of communion with the spirit of UConn. He's probably not wrong with that. He got in trouble for saying Jesus is in the huddle. The president of UConn is bringing Richard Dawkins in to give the presidential lecture in April. So they probably are trains going in opposite directions, to return to a previous subject. But yeah, in the scope of things, although I was one of the early people to say, well, he can't say that, Jesus in the huddle. But in the scope of all the things that are wrong with college football, this falls somewhere below the 50% line.
I completely agree. I thought we have this swift action on something like a comment about Jesus in the huddle, but very delayed response to more serious issues involving student safety and quality of life. So I think we have to talk about priorities, and we deserve to protect our students.
Yeah, and we've talked about this a few times in the show, including just recently. You know, there have been more talks at the state capitol about sexual violence on campus, right. And this is something that's ongoing, not just on the UConn campus, to be fair, but also at your university and every place
it's
else.
It's an issue for every institution of higher learning, and we have to have a serious conversation about how we encourage young people to protect themselves and how institutions need to support them.
Bill, I'll give you the last word.
The university took the right position on his original remarks, but the overall reaction was, just as you said, I thought it was overdone. If that's not the kind of problem you can handle quietly and quickly and without a lot of hubbub, but we don't know. We don't know. This university has yet to find the middle road here on how to deal with all kinds of cultural issues that arise.
Bill Curry is our regular Democratic panelist. He's a former nominee for governor. He's a former advisor to President Bill Clinton. It's always good to see you, Bill. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks to Dr. Kalila Brown, Dean, who's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Thank you so much for making the harrowing drive up from Hamden to come see us today.
Anything for you.
And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Colin is going to be back here again at 1 o'clock. We're at 231 Trumbull Street. It's right under the marquee of the XL Center on Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford. And you're going to be talking about the Civil War today.
Absolutely. Come on down.
So you can come on down. It's the Hartford Denim Company space. I'd like to thank everyone who produces the show. Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Katie Talarski, Tess Aronson, who helped us out today. Kyle Wolf taking photographs. This is where we live.